The Womanity Project. Let's talk about gender. Genders. Gender? Gender equality. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Womanity Project Live. I'm Aurélie Hart.
And I'm Celine Rosenthal, and you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn.
Last week, we started a conversation about women in Syria.
We interviewed Hani Al-Sayed, an award-winning journalist, radio host, and public speaker who escaped Syria and is now living in D.C.
I flew to D.C. a couple of months ago to interview Hani, and when I asked her who she would like to nominate for the Womanity Project, she said,
I would like to nominate Rafif Shurejati. She's a good friend of mine. She's a sister to me here. She's been one of those very reliable friends and has been through much, and I would like to nominate her strength to the Womanity Project. I wanted to nominate somebody that's Syrian. She's a Syrian American. She's one of the first people I met. We didn't agree on everything, especially on politics. But to be able to be friends and reliable friends no matter what, that means something. It's easy to make friends when you're preaching to the choir. It's not easy to make friends when you're not preaching to the choir. That means there's something human there. And I saw a lot of strength in her as well.
And she called her Syrian-American friend and asked her to come right away. And she did. So today, we're having a conversation with both of them.
So hello, Rafif Jouejati. Jouejati?
Jouejati.
Today's a bit special because you've been nominated by your friend, Hani Al-Sayed, and I have the pleasure to be with Hani today. So I think it's a first where Hani is going to be with us and participate in help me going through this interview.
Thank you. It's a great opportunity to help embarrass my friend here today.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Hani, so much for nominating me and for being part of this. And hopefully, since it's informal, I have an opportunity to embarrass my friend as well.
Great. That's amazing. So basically, you're an activist. Can we say that?
Yes. Yes.
You're Syrian. Mm-hmm. Living in America for a while?
Or? Born and raised in America.
Okay.
I've lived in Syria a few times in my life, but born and raised in the U.S.
Okay. You're an activist that is really trying to denounce the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
Absolutely. Denounce the regime of Bashar al-Assad and look forward to a transition of power. But I'm also now denouncing Daesh and all the Islamist armed groups that are pursuing a similar agenda to that of the Assad regime. My background is that my father was a career diplomat for Syria, and he served for as long as the foreign ministry was around. He was one of the founders of the Syrian foreign ministry post-independence from the French. He was a very liberal thinker and a pacifist. And my mother was a very strong character and a feminist in her own right. So she served in multiple capacities in Syria, and while she was with my father in his posts in various countries, she worked with the United Nations in Syria. She created programs for women's economic empowerment, and she never believed that a woman's role was merely to stay at home and take care of the husband and the children. She did that as well because it was expected of her, but in addition to that, she went out. She was always trying to learn new things and impart her knowledge, and I think that influenced me quite a bit. So I've always been feminist-leaning. I've always felt that the gender roles that were imposed on us by society were to be violated and corrected.
I hear you. I would like, I'm sure we're going to talk about it. So so you're the co-founder of the National Consensus Movement?
Yes, that is one group I'm a co-founder of. The idea was to form a secularist political party of sorts. And at the time we established it, we were very optimistic that the regime would collapse within months or maybe a year or maybe two. And as it became apparent that it wasn't going to be in months or a year or two, we focused our energies on other things.
Like?
Putting together the day after framework, which is the transition to a democratic Syria. Focusing on founding the foundation to restore equality and education in Syria. And a few other initiatives. I felt that more important than a political party were concepts like true equality among all Syrians, true representation for women, and opportunities to create educational platforms that differed from the standard Ba'athist curriculum.
So, we continued chatting, and as Hani mentioned, Rafif is very humble.
I don't know if you wanted to mention the Freedom Charter as well.
I would love to mention the Freedom Charter. So the biggest initiative I've undertaken with my colleagues is the Freedom Charter, the Syrian Freedom Charter, and it's modeled loosely after the South African version of 1955. Basically, we kept facing questions. We in the opposition kept facing statements like, nobody knows what the Syrian people want. And so we decided to answer that question. And so we gathered more than 100 activists and trained them to administer a survey. And the survey, sort of in summary, consisted of questions designed to decipher what Syrians want. We thought we would reach maybe 10,000 people or 20,000 people. In fact, we reached 50,333 Syrians, the majority of whom were inside Syria. The remainder were in refugee camps in Turkey and Lebanon, some in Jordan, and then a few people in expatriate communities. Once we analyzed the survey results, we took wherever we saw a consensus of 50% or more, we put those aside into what is the Freedom Charter. And it's a very simple statement of the will of the people. And so the Freedom Charter, two short pages, covers things like a demand for a separation of powers with an independent judiciary, a demand for a nation ruled based on the rule of law, a state in which all Syrians are equal regardless of ethnicity or background or faith, a state in which education is compulsory and free, and a state in which women have equal rights to men, and equal pay for equal work. It goes on. And so based on the success of the survey itself, because this really is the largest survey conducted among Syrians who are speaking freely, we've decided to extend the project, and now we're asking Syrians around the world to read it and debate it. And if they agree, we're asking them to sign it. If we collect enough signatures to this Freedom Charter, then it becomes a tool of change. And we can say honestly to the UN, to the international community, to the peace delegations, to the whole world, that this is what the Syrian people want. And if you disregard that will, based on geopolitical decisions you're making or proxy wars, you are ignoring something that is a foundational set of principles for a future democratic transition and for sustainable peace.
If you want to know more about the Freedom Charter, you can go online to www.free-syria-foundation.org/freedom-charter.
Wow. I am truly, truly, truly happy to be at this table today, because I think that's something everybody said when the war in Kuwait or Iraq happened, like the biggest problem was there was no transition thought or nobody asked. Mm-hmm. And to see that you with the Syrian people are taking your future in control, or trying at least to show and to think for exactly what you want and say what you want is amazing. So
thank you. Well, I think the reality is that Syrians are not in control of their destiny, and they're not in control of their near-term political future. But I think this will go down in history, if we collect enough signatures, that Syrians tried to be in control of their destiny. And I think ultimately this will serve a longer-term purpose.
Yeah. And as well to show that it's not about colonialism or one big power saying to the rest of the world what to do.
Let's give a bit of explanation and context here. Back in 2003, the US-led invasion of Iraq was very controversial. The aim was to overthrow the Ba'ath Party government of Saddam Hussein.
This military action would violate the UN Charter.
And, as confirmed by the Chilcot Report, you remember the Chilcot Report, we talked about it last week, Iraq's sovereignty was ignored and the invasion deemed illegal. Later in 2011, the same thing happened with the French-led coalition against General Gaddafi in Libya. The superpuissance, or superpowers, were once again acting as the policemen of the world and deciding the future of other nations.
Creating more mess, terrorism, and refugees. This is why the Freedom Charter is so important, to give the Syrian people a voice and official recognition by the UN.
Back to Rafif. Let's hear what she has to say about the Syrian refugees.
Just last month, I was in southern Turkey and I visited an orphanage. I spent the day at an orphanage and I was with some 30 girls, 13 and under. They felt that their career paths as girls were limited to being a seamstress or a hairdresser. And just in speaking with them, not pressuring them, but just trying to explain that there was a world of possibilities, I have had young girls tell me, oh, well, you know, in fact, I want to be a journalist. Or I want to be a neurosurgeon. And so it made me proud to be a woman, but it sort of inspired me, and I realized that these girls need to be, at least in my case, my moral compass. The oldest child, a 13-year-old girl, had just been granted a full scholarship to a boarding school in Italy, and her dream is to become a neurosurgeon. So she's going off to Italy, and she has a full scholarship. So, you know, good for her. In meeting with the 29 other girls, I asked if I could film them just with my cell phone, and they gave me permission. And after a few minutes of filming them, just talking and playing, they asked if we could conduct interviews. And I said, sure. And so we used a carnation as our microphone, and we had my phone. And then as we were doing these interviews of, you know, what's your name and what's your favorite food and what's your favorite color, a couple of the more confident girls stepped forward and they wanted to do interviews. And so as the hours went by, we interviewed the 29 girls, and at least three or four of them now want to become journalists.
Wow.
And they were interviewing each other. They were making a movie. They liked to yell out things like action and cut. You know, they were growing progressively more confident with every passing hour. And what moved me personally was the transformation. These girls do not think of themselves as orphans. They think of themselves as being part of a large family at this orphanage. They have taken ownership of their orphanage. They call it their home. They want to be productive members of society. And given the opportunity to talk with somebody who, of course, is much older and looks like a foreigner and even speaks Arabic with a little bit of an accent, for them to have undivided attention and just be encouraged to speak freely, I think made a huge difference for them. And for me, the impact was almost indescribable. Mm. And so what I do is not for me, but for future generations of girls and boys to understand that anybody can be whatever they want, and they need to shoot for the moon. They need to not settle for stereotypical roles, and they need to not allow others to impose on them.
What do you say then to the fact that they are refugees, or whether they're internally displaced or in camps today, that the mere fact of dreaming seems to be impossible, and then allowing them to accomplish those dreams? What opportunities do they have as refugees? What doors are even open for such generations?
Very few doors are open for these people, and that is sort of a blight on humanity, and particularly the international community when it comes to dealing with Syria and Syrian civilians. But listen, these people have nothing but their dreams. You know, their homes have been destroyed. They have either been forced out of their villages or they have fled to preserve their lives. They have virtually nothing in the sense of material possessions, and they really don't have enough to eat. So if they can dream, I think we owe it to them to encourage them to dream and then see what we can do to help make those dreams a reality. They won't be refugees forever. Most of the refugees I have spoken with, and of course I haven't spoken with that many on a relative scale since there are now many millions, but the refugees I have spoken with of all ages have all expressed a desire to go back home and rebuild their country. And so the dream of being a neurosurgeon or an architect or a journalist is even that much more important to follow.
You are listening to The Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn.
And you're a mother yourself?
I am a mother. I have two boys.
Okay.
Who are being raised as feminists. Thank you very much.
I can.
Do you talk to them about when you travel and when you meet these young people?
I try to talk to my children about my travels and the things I do. They're very aware of my activities. They're very aware of the Syrian revolution because they've been following it with me for the past 5+ years. They've said that the revolution has done great things for them and bad things for them. They, on the negative side, they say they feel that to some extent they lost their mother. But on the positive side, they've met a lot of great friends, and they have a much more heightened awareness of how much they have and how lucky they are. And I think that's an important insight for them. They're 12 and 14, and I think this is the right age for them to be learning lessons about gratitude and knowing how lucky they are.
Wow, yeah, because it's strong to say they love their mother, because you're traveling a lot, I guess.
Because I travel a lot, because the Syrian revolution just so consumed me, and I threw myself into it with a passion that I've never experienced before. And really at the expense of not only my children, but many other aspects of my life.
I'm sure.
Would you do it differently if time would go back in time 5 years ago, 4 years ago?
You know, I would like to say there were things I would change. I would like to say I could have, would have, should have done more of this and less of that. But at the end of the day, I can't go back in time. And I don't know that I would have been any different. For me, it was almost a personal attack the moment I saw regime soldiers firing live ammunition at unarmed kids. And I say kids because the range in age for protesters was from 10 to maybe 22. And then later, the older generation got more involved. But this was a revolution inspired by youth and led by youth, and for a regime to have no other option than a military one in the face of banners and songs and creativity was completely unacceptable. And so I think I probably would have just done exactly the same thing.
And in the movement, the people you're working with, did you know them before, or would you say the revolution brought you all together? How did that work?
I work with a great many colleagues who I did not know before the revolution. And so I'm privileged to have met them, although I don't like the circumstances. And as time went by, I had the occasion to meet up again with friends from Syria who had decided to speak out against the regime as well. At the very beginning, there was a lot of fear, and so many people in my circle and in my former circle in Syria were very hesitant to come out in support of a revolution. And they eventually overcame that fear, so it was good to reconnect with them.
And you would say, like, your feminism in that fight, did that come all together as important as the freedom, I would say, or the saving the people? Mm-hmm. How was it received within the group?
So, you know, at the beginning, this really had nothing to do with a feminist agenda. The idea was freedom and dignity and democracy for all Syrians. And if you accept that blanket statement, then, you know, everybody's covered. You don't need to question. But then we saw opposition groups starting to form, and they were dominated by men. We heard panel discussions. We saw different kinds of platforms and public debates, and they were dominated by men. And so I started to say, well, where are the women? And the response was always, it's not the right time. Don't worry about it. Let's focus on overthrowing the regime, and then we'll talk about the women's issue. And I would say, well, wait a minute, I'm not raising a women's issue. We're saying democracy and dignity and freedom for all Syrians. And by my count, we are 50% of society. So let's have a little bit more inclusion here, more representation. That narrative of let's keep it until after the regime collapses, took off among the men. And so after maybe a year or two into the revolution, I started making women's representation more of my priority. If we're going to succeed in overthrowing the regime, we need to overthrow it in favor of a government that is truly representative of all Syrians, regardless of gender and regardless of everything else that makes us Syrian.
I asked Rafif what she thought would happen to the status of women in new post-war Syrian society.
So I would break it down. I mean, legally, discrimination based on gender was... It was illegal to discriminate based on gender pre-revolution. This is on the books. But what happens in practice is what happens anywhere in the world. There is sexism everywhere. Also, from a social aspect, most Syrian families tend to be more conservative. And so there are cultural and social almost barriers to progress. So from that perspective, I think the revolution and the quest for freedom of everybody meant that there would also be a social revolution and a cultural revolution, one that said that now let's break down the barriers of traditions that we can respect and honor but don't need to implement because they're no longer relevant in today's society, particularly after women have taken to the streets in protest, after they've conducted sit-ins, after they have defied regime authorities, after they have taken up arms in some cases, after they have been equal partners in a revolution for freedom, how can we go back to a time when women are oppressed because of their gender or because of archaic traditions that no longer apply? I don't know if Hani sees it differently.
No, we spoke about that. I wanted to ask you there's a lot of stereotyping that, yeah, but the women are vulnerable, and so let's marginalize them, and we're going to protect them. We're the men. We're going to do that for them, and especially in a war zone or during conflict. What do you think of that?
Everybody's vulnerable because the Russian airstrike does not stop to ask whether one is a woman, a child, a man, a Christian, a Druze, a Sunni, an Alawi. In a war zone, every civilian is vulnerable. I know the stereotype is usually that women are more emotional and therefore they cannot be responsible for decisions. I think we could all use a little bit more emotion and passion in making decisions that impact the lives of millions of people. Maybe women are better equipped to express their emotions, but I don't think that lessens at all their ability to think critically or analytically or to make sound decisions. I think most men who have this attitude that women are more emotional are the very types of people to make rash decisions and rush to take up weapons and cause the loss of life when there are other options available to them. And so that's my response. And you've actually made me a little angry.
I wanted to get the Rafif out of you.
Well, funny, because listening to you, I'm like, you're ready. You're ready to go. Yeah. And, do you think one day you'll run for politics or...
I'm asking her to run for president. I don't know.
I'm not going to run for office. I'm going to encourage other women to do that. I would like to mentor other women to the extent that I'm qualified to mentor, and I'd like to be mentored. I think all of us have to keep learning. And I would love to encourage and really get behind many women to run for public office.
Do you still have family in Syria? Or
yes.
Yes.
In Damascus.
Okay. And you're still in regular contact with them?
Not so regular contact with them. With some of them, we simply aren't close, and therefore there would be no reason to be in contact with them. In other cases, we don't want to be in contact because their phones, of course, are tapped, and they don't want to have any more trouble. But I also have family now in Turkey and Sweden and Germany and Canada and France and a few other countries, I'm sure. So, yeah, I have family. We've become so international now.
It's interesting to see how countries are welcoming people or not, but Canada seems to be...
Canada's amazing.
Okay, yeah.
Canada is amazing, and Trudeau is just so refreshing to see, especially in the context of other world leaders. Angela Merkel has been pretty tremendous.
Criticized like crazy, of course,
because she's doing the right thing. She's showing herself to be a humanitarian above all, and she's talking about humanity first. So, of course, she's going to come under a lot of criticism, especially from all these right-wing parties that are sweeping the entire world, these sort of neo-Nazis that are...
France is a terrible example.
Absolutely. So we have a lot to worry about.
Thank you so much to Rafif and Hani.
That brings us to the end of our episode. So we'd like to thank Mick O'Connor, our lovely, lovely sound designer, Lizzie Hagstedt for the compositions, and of course, Radio Free Brooklyn. Coming next is Sin Smith Radio Theater Collage.
Tune in next week, The Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time.
And now we'll leave you with an original by Kifak Inta by Feruz.
تذكر آخر مرة شفتك سنتا تذكر وقتها آخر كلمة قلتها وما عدت شفتها وهلأ شفتها كيفك انت ملا انت تذكر آخر سهرة سهرتها عنا كان في وحدة مضايق منا هيدي أمي بتعتل همي منك انت ملا انت كيفك آخر مرة شو قلت لي بدك ضلي بدك فيك تفلي سألت بوقتها وما حللتها Mil